Mr. Crosby Wells. The estate, as recorded by Mr. Nielsen, includes a great deal of pure ore, since valued by the bank at £4,096 exactly. What can you tell me about this bonanza? Staines answered without hesitation. The ore was found upon the claim known as the Aurora, he said, which, until recently, belonged to me. It was excavated by my employee, Mr. Quee, in the middle months of last year. Mr. Quee retorted the metal into squares, as was his personal custom, and then submitted these squares to me as legal earnings. When I received the bonanza, I did not bank it against the Aurora, as I was legally obliged to do. Instead, I bagged it up, took it to the Arahura Valley, and buried it. He spoke calmly and without conceit.
"Why the Arahura, specifically?" said Broom.
"Because you can't prospect on Maori land, and most of the Arahura belongs to the Maoris," said Staines. "I thought it would be safest there, at least for the while, until I came back and dug it up again."
"What did you intend to do with the bonanza?"
"I plan to cut it down the middle," said Staines, "and keep half of it for myself. The other half I meant to give to Miss Wetherill as a gift."
"Why should you wish to do such a thing?"
He looked puzzled. "I'm afraid I don't understand the question, sir."
"What did you mean to achieve, Mr. Staines, by presenting Miss Wetherill with this sum of money?"
"Nothing at all," said the boy.
"You meant to achieve nothing at all?"
"Yes, exactly," said Staines, brightening a little. "It wouldn't be a gift otherwise, would it?"
"That fortune," said Broham, raising his voice above the scattered laughter, "was later discovered in the cottage belonging to the late Crosby Wells. How did this relocation come about?"
"I don't know for sure. I expect that he dug it up and took it for himself."
"If that was indeed the case, why do you suppose that Mr. Wells did not take it to the bank?"
"Isn't it obvious?" said Staines.
"I'm afraid it isn't," said Broham.
"Because the ore was smelted, of course," said Staines, "and each one of those blocks bore the word Aurora engraved into the very metal by my Mr. Quee. He could hardly pretend he'd lifted it from the ground."
"Why did you not bank the bonanza against the Aurora as you were legally obliged?"
50% shares on the Aurora belong to Mr. Francis Carver," said Staines. "I have a poor opinion of the man, and I did not want to see him profit."
Broom frowned. "You removed the bonanza from the Aurora because you did not want to pay the 50% dividends legally owing to Mr. Carver. However, you intended to give 50% of this same bonanza to Miss Anna Wetherill. Is that right?"
"Exactly right."
"You will forgive me if I consider your intentions somewhat illogical, Mr. Staines."
"What's illogical about it?" said the boy. "I wanted Anna to have Carver's share."
"For what reason?"
"Because she deserved to have it, and he deserved to lose it," said Emery Staines.
More laughter, more widespread this time. Moody was becoming anxious. He had warned Staines against speaking too fancifully or too pertly. When it was quiet again, the justice said,
"I do not believe that it is your prerogative, Mr. Staines, to adjudicate what a person does or does not deserve. You will kindly restrict yourself in the future to factual statements only."
Staines sobered at once.
"I understand, sir," he said.
The justice nodded.
"Continue, Mr. Broom."
Abruptly, Broom changed the subject.
"You were absent from Hokitika for over 2 months," he said.
"What caused your absence?"
"I'm ashamed to say that I've been under the effects of opium, sir," said Staines. "I was astonished to discover, upon my return, that over 2 months had passed."
"Where have you been?"
"I believe I've spent much of the time in the opium den at Canyeri Chinatown," said Staines, "but I couldn't tell you for sure."
Brum paused.
"The opium den," he repeated.
"Yes, sir," said Staines. "The proprietor was a fellow named Sook, Ah Sook."
Broom did not want to dwell on the subject of Ah Sook.
"You were discovered," he said, On the 20th of March, in the cottage that once belonged to Crosby Wells. What were you doing there?
I believe I was looking for my bonanza, said Staines. Only I got a little muddled. I was unwell, and I couldn't remember where I'd buried it.
When did you first develop a dependency upon opium, Mr. Staines?
I first touched the drug on the night of the 14th of January.
In other words, the very night that Crosby Wells died.
So they tell me.
A bit of a coincidence, wouldn't you say?
Moody objected to this.
Mr. Wells died of natural causes, he said. I cannot see how any coincidence with a natural event can be a significant one.
In fact, said Broome, the post-mortem revealed a small quantity of laudanum in Mr. Wells' stomach.
A small quantity, Moody repeated.
Continue with your interrogation, Mr. Broome, said the justice. Sit down, Mr. Moody.
Thank you, sir, said Broome to the justice.
He turned back to Staines.
Can you think of a reason, Mr. Staines, why Mr. Wells might have taken any quantity of laudanum together with a great quantity of whisky?
Perhaps he was in pain.
Pain of what kind?
I am speculating, said Staines. I'm afraid I can only speculate. I did not know the man's personal habits intimately, and I was not with him that evening. I mean only that laudanum is often taken as a pain relief, or as an aid to sleep.
Not on top of a bottle of whisky, it's not.
I certainly would not attempt such a combination myself, but I cannot answer for Mr. Wells.
Do you take laudanum, Mr. Staines?
Only when prescribed, not as a habit.
Do you have a prescription currently?
Currently I do, said Staines, but it is a very recent prescription.
How recent, please?
It was first administered to me on the 20th of March, said Staines, as a pain relief, and as a method of weaning me from my addiction.
Prior to the 20th of March, have you ever purchased or otherwise obtained a phial of laudanum from Pritchard's Drug Emporium on Collingwood Street?
No.
A phial of laudanum was discovered in Crosby Wells' cottage some days after his death, said Broome. Do you know how it got there?
No.
Was Mr. Wells, to your knowledge, dependent upon opiates?
He was a drunk, said Staines. That's all I know.
Broome studied him.
Please tell the court how you spent the night of the 14th of January, in sequence, and in your own words.
I met with Anna Wetherill at the Dust and Nugget around 7, said Staines. We had a drink together, and after that we went back to my apartment on Revel Street. I fell asleep, and when I woke, around 10:30, I suppose, she'd gone. I couldn't think why she might have left so suddenly, and I went out to find her. I went to the Gridiron. There was nobody at the front desk, and nobody on the landing, and the door of her room upstairs was unlocked. I entered, and saw her laid out on the floor, with her pipe and the resin and the lamp arranged around her. Well, I couldn't rouse her, and while I was waiting for her to come to, I knelt down to take a look at the apparatus. I'd never touched opium before, but I'd always longed to try it. There's such a mystique about it, you know, and the smoke is so lovely and thick. Her pipe was still warm, and the lamp was still burning, and everything seemed serendipitous somehow. I thought I might just taste it. She looked so marvellously happy. She was even smiling.
"What happened next?" said Broome, when Staines did not go on.
"I went under, of course," said Staines. "It was heavenly."
Broome looked annoyed.
"And after that?"
"Well, I had a pretty decent go at her pipe, and then I lay down on her bed and slept for a bit, or dreamed. It wasn't sleep, exactly. When I came up again, the lamp was cold, and the bowl of the pipe was empty, and Anna was gone. I'm ashamed to say I didn't even spare her a thought. All I wanted was another taste. It was such a thirst, you see. From the first sip, I was enchanted. I knew I couldn't rest until I tried the drug again."
"All this from your very first taste," said Broome, sceptically.
"Yes," said Staines.
"What did you do?"
I made for the den in Chinatown at once. It was early, just past dawn. I saw no one on the road at all.
How long did you remain in Canieri Chinatown?
I think a fortnight, but it's hard to recall exactly. Each day blurred into the next. Ah Suk was ever so kind to me. He took me in, fed me, made sure I never ate too much. He kept tally of my debts on a little chalkboard.
Did you see anyone else over this period?
No, said Staines, but really I can't remember much at all.
What is the next thing you remember?
I woke up one day and Ah Suk was not there. I became very upset. He had taken his opium with him. He always did when he left the den. And I turned the place over, looking for it, becoming more and more desperate. And then I remembered Miss Wetherill's supply. I set off for Hokitika at once, in a frenzy. It was raining very heavily that morning, and there were not many people about, and I made it to Hokitika without seeing anyone I knew. I entered the gridiron by the rear door and ascended the servants' staircase at the back. I waited until Anna went down to luncheon, and then I slipped into her room and found the resin and all her apparatus in her drawer. Then I got trapped. Someone struck up a conversation in the hallway just outside the door, and I couldn't leave. And then Anna came back from lunch, and I heard her coming, and I panicked again, so I hid behind the drapes.
The drapes?
Yes, said Staines. That's where I was hiding when I took the bullet from Anna's gun.
Broom's face was growing red.
How long did you remain hidden behind the drapes?
Hours, said Staines. If I were to guess, I'd say from about 12 until about 3, but that is an estimation.
Did Miss Wetherill know that you were in her room on that day?
No.
What about Mr. Gascoigne or Mr. Pritchard?
No, said Staines again. I kept very quiet and stood very still. I'm certain that none of them knew that I was there.
Fellows was whispering intently in Harrington's ear.
What happened when you were shot? Said Broom.
I kept quiet, said Staines again.
You kept quiet?
Yes.
Mr. Staines, said Broom, in a voice that pretended to scold him. Do you mean to tell this courtroom that you were shot quite without warning and at a very close range, and you did not cry out or move or make any noise at all that might have alerted any one of the 3 witnesses to your presence?
Yes, said Staines.
How on earth did you not cry out?
I didn't want to give up the resin, said Staines.
Broom studied him. In the ensuing pause, Harrington passed him a piece of paper, which Broom scanned briefly, then looked up and said,
Do you think it possible, Mr. Staines, that Miss Wetherill might have known that you were present upon the afternoon of the 27th of January, and that she might have fired her pistol deliberately in the direction of the drapes with the express purpose of causing you harm?
No, said Staines, I do not think it possible.
The courtroom had become very still.
Why not?
Because I trust her, said Staines.
I am asking if you think it possible, said Broom, not if you think it probable.
I understand the question. My answer is unchanged.
What induced you to place your trust in Miss Wetherill?
Trust cannot be induced, he burst out. It can only be given, and given freely. How am I possibly to answer that?
I will simplify my question, the lawyer said. Why do you trust Miss Wetherill?
I trust her because I love her, said Staines.
And how did you come to love her?
By trusting her, of course.
You make a circular defence.
Yes, the boy cried, because I must. True feeling is always circular, either circular or paradoxical, simply because its cause and its expression are 2 halves of the very same thing. Love cannot be reduced to a catalogue of reasons why, and a catalogue of reasons cannot be put together into love. Any man who disagrees with me has never been in love. Not truly.
A perfect silence followed this remark. From the far corner of the courtroom there came a low whistle,
and in response to it smothered laughter. Broom was plainly irritated.
"You will forgive me for remarking, Mr. Staines, that it is rather unusual to steal opiates from the person one professes to love."
"I know it's very bad," Staines said. "I'm very ashamed of what I did."
"Can anyone confirm your movements over the past 2 months?"
"Ah, Sook can vouch for me."
"Mr. Sook is deceased. Anyone else?"
Staines thought for a moment and then shook his head. "I can't think of anybody else."
"I have no further questions," said Broom curtly. "Thank you, Mr. Justice."
"Your witness, Mr. Moody,"
said the Justice. Moody thanked him also. He spent a moment putting his notes in order and waiting for the whispering in the room to subside before he said,
"You have testified that your opinion of Mr. Carver is a poor one, Mr. Staines. What caused this poor opinion?"
"He assaulted Anna," said Staines. "He beat her in cold blood, and she was carrying a child. The child was killed."
The courtroom was quiet at once. "When did this assault take place?" said Moody.
"On the afternoon of the 11th of October last year."
"The 11th of October," Moody echoed. "Did you bear witness to this assault?"
"No, I did not."
"How did you learn of its occurrence?"
"From Mr. Lerventhal, later that afternoon. He was the one who found her in the road, all battered and bloody. He can vouch for her condition when he found her."
"What was your business with Mr. Lerventhal that afternoon?"
"An unrelated matter," said Staines. "I called on him because I wanted to put a notice in the paper."
"Regarding?"
"The purchase of a crate of Long Toms."
"When you heard the news that Miss Wetherill had been assaulted," said Moody, "were you surprised?"
"No," said Staines. "I already knew Carver was a beast, and already I regretted our association 10 times over. He'd offered to be my sponsor when I first arrived in Dunedin. That was how I met him, you see, when I was just off the boat that very day. I didn't suspect anything foul. I was very green. We shook hands in good faith, and that was that. But it wasn't long before I started hearing things about him, and about Mrs. Carver, too. They work as a team, of course. When I heard what they did to Mr. Wells, I was horrified. I've gone into business with a perfect swindler, I thought."
The boy was getting ahead of himself. Moody coughed to remind him of the narrative sequence upon which they had agreed, and said, "Let's go back to the night of the 11th of October. What did you do when Mr. Lerventhal advised you that Miss Wetherill had been assaulted?"
"I made for the Arahura Valley directly to give the news to Mr. Wells."
"Why did you consider the information to be of importance to Mr. Wells?"
"Because he was the father of the child Miss Wetherill was carrying," said Staines, "and I thought he might want to know that his child had been killed."
By now, the courtroom was so quiet that Moody could hear the distant bustle of the street. "How did Mr. Wells respond upon receipt of the news that his unborn child was dead?"
"He was very quiet," said Staines. "He didn't say much at all. We had a drink together and sat a while. I stayed late."
"Did you discuss any other matters with Mr. Wells that evening?"
"I told him about the fortune I had buried near his cottage. I said that if Anna survived the night, she had been very badly beaten, then I would give her Carver's share."
"Was your intention put down in writing on that night?"
"Wells drew up a document," said Staines, "but I didn't sign."
"Why not?"
"I don't exactly remember why not," said Staines. "I had been drinking, and by then it was very late. Perhaps the conversation turned to other themes, or perhaps I meant to and I forgot about it. Anyway, I slept a while and then returned to Hokitika in the early morning to check on Miss Wetherill's progress to recovery. I never saw Mr. Wells again."
"Did you tell Mr. Wells where the ore was buried?"
"Yes," said Staines. "I described the site in general terms."
Next, the magistrate's court heard the testimonies of Mannering, Quay, Lerventhal, Clinch, Nielsen, and Frost,
all of whom described the discovery and deployment of the fortune discovered in Crosby Wells Cottage quite as if the retorted gold had indeed been discovered upon the Aurora. Mannering testified to the conditions under which the Aurora had been sold, and Cui to the fact of the ore's retorsion. Lerventhal detailed his interview with Alistair Lauderback on the night of the 14th of January, during which he learnt about the death of Crosby Wells. Clinch testified that he had purchased the estate the following morning. Nielsen described how the gold had been hidden in Crosby Wells' cottage, and Frost confirmed its value. They made no mention whatsoever of Anna's gowns, nor of the foundered bark Godspeed, nor of any of the concerns and revelations that had precipitated their secret council in the Crown Hotel 3 months ago. Their examinations passed without incident, and in very little time, it seemed, the justice was calling Mrs. Lydia Carver to the stand. She was dressed in her gown of striped charcoal, and over it a smart black riding jacket with puffed leg o' mutton sleeves. Her copper hair, wonderfully bright, was piled high upon her head, the chignon held in place with a black band of velvet. As she swept by the barrister's bench, Moody caught the scent of camphor, lemons, and aniseed, an emphatic scent, and one that recalled him, in a moment, to the party at the Wayfarer's Fortune prior to the séance. Mrs. Carver mounted the steps to the witness box almost briskly, but when she saw Emery Staines seated on the stand behind the rail, she appeared momentarily to falter. Her hesitation was very brief. In the next moment she collected herself. She turned her back on Staines, smiled at the bailiff, and raised her milky hand to be sworn in. "Mrs. Carver," said Brum, after the bailiff had stepped back from the stand, "are you acquainted with the defendant, Mr. Emery Staines?"
"I'm afraid I've never had the pleasure of making the acquaintance of a Mr. Emery Staines," said Mrs. Carver.
Moody, glancing at the boy, was surprised to see that he was blushing.
"I understand that on the night of the 18th of February you staged a séance in order to make contact with him, however," Brougham said.
"That is correct."
"Why did you choose Mr. Staines, of all people, as the subject of your séance?"
"The truth is rather mercenary, I'm afraid," said Mrs. Carver, smiling slightly. "At that time, his disappearance was the talk of the town, and I thought that his name might help to draw a crowd. That was all."
"Did you know, when you advertised this séance, that the fortune discovered in your late husband's cottage had originated upon the gold mine Aurora?"
"No, I did not," said Mrs. Carver.
"Did you have any reason to connect Mr. Staines with your late husband?"
"No reason at all. He was just a name to me. All I knew about him was that he had vanished from the gorge, and that he had left a great many assets behind him."
"Did you not know that your husband, Mr. Carver, owned shares in Mr. Staines' gold mine?"
"Oh," she said, "I don't talk investment with Francis."
"When did you first learn of the Bonanza's true origin?"
"When the Reserve Bank published the notice in the paper in late March, asserting that the gold had in fact been found smelted and was therefore traceable."
Brougham turned to the justice.
"The court will note that this announcement appeared in the West Coast Times on the 23rd day of March this year."
"Duly noted, Mr. Brougham."
Brougham turned back to Mrs. Carver.
"You first arrived in Hokitika on Thursday, the 25th of January, 1866, upon the steamer Waikato," he said. "Immediately upon landing, you made an appointment at the courthouse to contest the sale of your late husband's cottage and land. Is that correct?"
"That is correct."
"How had you learned of Mr. Wells' death?"
"Mr. Carver had conveyed the news to me in person," said Mrs. Carver. "Naturally, I made for Hokitika as swiftly as I was able. I would have liked to have attended the funeral. Unfortunately, I was too late."
"At the time you left Dunedin, did you know that the bulk of Mr. Wells' estate comprised a fortune of unknown origin?"
"No. It was not until I arrived in Hokitika that I read the account given in the West Coast Times.
I understand that you sold your house and business in Dunedin prior to your departure, however.
Yes, I did, said Mrs. Carver, but it was not as radical a move as you might suppose. I am in the entertainment business, and the crowds at Dunedin are not what they once were. I'd been considering a move to the West Coast for many months, and reading the West Coast Times with keen attention, with that future purpose in mind. When I read of Crosby's death, it seemed the perfect opportunity. I could start anew in a place where business was sure to be good, and I could also be close to his grave, which I very much desired. As I have said, we did not have a chance to resolve our differences before his death, and our separation had cut me very keenly.
You and Mr. Wells were living apart at the time of his death, were you not?
We were.
How long had you been living apart?
Some 9 months, I believe.
What was the reason for your estrangement?
Mr. Wells had violated my trust, said Mrs. Carver.
She did not go on, so Broome, with a nervous glance at the justice, said,
Can you elaborate on that, please?
Mrs. Carver tossed her head.
There was a young woman in my charge, she said, whom Mr. Wells had used abominably. Crosby and I had a dreadful row over her, and shortly after our disagreement, he quit Dunedin. I did not know where he went, and I did not hear from him. It was only when I read his obituary in the West Coast Times that I found out where he had gone.
The young woman in question,
Miss Anna Wetherill,
said Mrs. Carver, crisply.
I had done her a charity by taking her in, for which she was, as she asserted, very grateful. Mr. Wells tarnished that charity. Miss Wetherill abused it.
Did the acquaintance between Miss Wetherill and Mr. Wells continue after their joint relocation to Hokitika?
I haven't the faintest idea, said Mrs. Carver.
Thank you, Mrs. Carver. I have no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Broome, she said serenely.
Moody was already pushing his chair back, waiting for the invitation from the justice to rise.
Mrs. Carver, he said promptly when the invitation came, in the month of March 1864, your late husband, Crosby Wells, made a strike in the Dunstan Valley, is that correct?
Mrs. Carver was visibly surprised by this question, but she paused only briefly before saying,
Yes, that is correct.
But Mr. Wells did not report this bonanza to the bank. Is that also correct?
Also correct, said Mrs. Carver.
Instead, he employed a private escort to transport the ore from Dunstan back to Dunedin, where you, his wife, received it.
A flicker of alarm showed in Mrs. Carver's expression.
Yes,
she said cautiously.
Can you describe how the ore was packed and then transported from the field?
She hesitated, but Moody's line of questioning had evidently caught her off guard, and she had not time enough to form an alibi.
It was packed into an office safe, she said at last.
The safe was loaded into a carriage, and the carriage was escorted back to Dunedin by a team of men, armed, of course.
In Dunedin I collected the safe, paid the bearers, and wrote at once to Mr. Wells to let him know that the safe had arrived safely, at which point he sent on the key.
Was the gold escort appointed by you or by Mr. Wells?
Mr. Wells made the appointment, said Mrs. Carver. They were very good. They never gave us an ounce of trouble. It was a private business, Gracewood and Sons, or something to that effect.
Gracewood and Spears, Moody corrected. The enterprise has since relocated to Canieri.
Indeed,
said Mrs. Carver.
What did you do with the bonanza once it was delivered safely to you?
The ore remained inside the safe. I installed the safe at our residence on Cumberland Street, and there it stayed.
Why did you not take the metal to a bank?
The price of gold was fluctuating daily, and the market for gold was very unpredictable, said Mrs. Carver. We thought it best to wait until it was a good time to sell. By your degree of caution, I would hazard to guess the value of the bonanza was considerable. Yes, she said. Several thousand, we thought. We never had it valued. Following the strike, did Mr. Wells remain upon the field? Yes, he continued to prospect for another year, until the following spring. He was buoyed by his success, and felt that he might get lucky a second time. But he did not. "Where is the bonanza now?" Moody asked. She hesitated again and then said, "It was stolen." "My condolences," said Moody. "You must have been devastated by the loss." "We were," said Mrs. Carver. "You speak on behalf of yourself and Mr. Wells, presumably." "Of course." Moody paused again and then said, "I presume that the thief gained access somehow to the key." "Perhaps," said Mrs. Carver, "or perhaps the lock was unreliable. The safe was of a modern design, and as we all know, modern technologies are never infallible. It's also possible that a second key was cast without our knowledge." "Did you have any idea who might have stolen the bonanza?" "None at all." "Would you agree that it is likely to have been someone in your close acquaintance?" "Not necessarily," said Mrs. Carver, tossing her head. "Any member of the gold escort might have betrayed us. They knew for a fact that there was a fortune in pure colour at No. 35 Cumberland Street, and they knew the location of the safe besides. It might have been anyone." "Did you open the safe regularly to check upon the contents?" "Not regularly, no." "When did you first discover that the fortune was missing?"
"When Crosby returned the following year."
"Can you describe what happened when you made this discovery?"
"Mr. Wells came back from the fields, and we sat down to take stock of our finances together. He opened the safe and saw that it was empty. You can be sure that he was absolutely furious, as was I."
"What month was this?"
"Oh, I don't know," said Mrs. Carver, suddenly flustered. "April, maybe, or May."
"April or May of 1865, last year?"
"Yes," she said.
"Thank you, Mrs. Carver," said Moody. And then to the justice, "Thank you, sir." He felt, as he sat down, that the atmosphere in the courtroom was quickening. Harrington and Fellows had ceased their whispering, and the justice was no longer taking notes. Every pair of eyes in the room watched Mrs. Carver as she descended the steps from the witness box and sat down.
"The court calls Mr. Francis Carver!"
Carver was handsome in a dark green jacket and a pinned cravat. He gave his oath with his usual terse accent, and then turned, his expression sober, to face the barrister's bench. Broome looked up from his notes.
"Mr. Carver," he said, "please describe for the court how you first came to be acquainted with Mr. Staines."
"I met him in Dunedin," said Carver, "around about this time last year. He was fresh off the boat from Sydney, and looking to set himself up as a prospector. I offered to be his sponsor, and he accepted."
"What did this sponsorship require of each of you?"
"I'd loan him enough money to set him up on the diggings, and in return he'd be obliged to give me half shares in his first venture, with dividends in perpetuity."
"What was the exact monetary value of your sponsorship?"
"I bought his swag and a store of provisions. I paid for his ticket over to the coast. He was facing down a gambling debt in Dunedin. I paid that, too."
"Can you guess at a total value, please?"
"I suppose I stood him £8. Something in the neighbourhood of £8. He got the short-term leg up, and I got the long-term payoff. That was the idea."
"What was Mr. Staines' first venture?"
"He bought a 2-acre plot of land within a mile of Canyere," said Carver, "known as the Aurora. He wrote to me from Hokitika once he'd made his purchase. and forwarded on all the papers from the bank.
How were the Aurora dividends paid out to you?
By money order, care of the Reserve Bank.
And in what frequency did these payments occur?
Every quarter.
What was the exact value of the dividend payment you received in October 1865?
£8 and change.
And what was the exact value of the dividend payment you received in January 1866?
£6 even.
Over the last two quarters of last year, then, you received a total of approximately £14 in dividends.
That is correct.
In that case, Aurora's total net profit must have been recorded as approximately £28 over a six-month period.
Yes.
Did Mr. Staines make any mention to you of the bonanza discovered upon the Aurora by the Chinaman John Quee?
No.
Were you aware, at the time of falsification, that Mr. Staines had falsified the Aurora's quarterly report?
No.
When did you first become aware that the bonanza discovered in the cottage of the late Mr. Wells had originated from the Aurora mine?
The same time everyone else did, said Carver. When the bank published their records in the paper, saying that the ore had been found smelted, not pure, and that the smelting bore a signature.
Broom nodded, then, coughing slightly, changed the subject.
Mr. Staines has testified that he holds you in poor esteem, Mr. Carver.
Maybe he does, said Carver, but he never spoke a word to me about it.
Did you, as Mr. Staines alleges, assault Miss Wetherill on the 11th of October?
I slapped her face, said Carver. That's all.
From the gallery, Moody heard a low growl of disapproval.
What provoked you to slap her face? Said Broom.
She was insolent, said Carver.
Can you elaborate on that?
I asked her for a direction, and she had a laugh at my expense, so I slapped her. It was the first and only time I ever laid a hand on her.
Can you describe the encounter as you remember it, please?
I was in Hokitika on business, Carver said, and I thought I'd ride to Canieri to have a look at the Aurora. The quarterly report had just come in, and I could see that the claim wasn't pulling good dust, so I went to find out why. I met Miss Wetherill on the side of the road. She was up to the eyes in opium and talking nonsense. I couldn't get anything out of her, so I remounted and rode on.
Mr. Staines has testified that Miss Wetherill lost her child that very same day.
I don't know anything about that, said Carver. Last I saw her, she was still laughing and stumbling about. Maybe she came to trouble after I left.
Can you remember what you asked her that afternoon?
Yes. I wanted to find Wells, said Carver.
Why were you seeking news of Mr. Wells?
I had a private matter to discuss with him, said Carver. I hadn't seen him since May, and I didn't know where to find him or who to ask. As Lydia said, he up and quit Dunedin in the night. Didn't tell anyone where he was going.
Did Miss Wetherill divulge Mr. Wells' whereabouts to you at that time?
No, said Carver. She only laughed. That was why I slapped her.
Do you believe that Miss Wetherill knew where Mr. Wells was living, and that she was concealing this information from you for a specific purpose?
Carver thought about this, but then he shook his head.
Don't know. Wouldn't want to say.
What was the nature of the business you wished to discuss with Mr. Wells?
Insurance, said Carver.
In what respect?
He shrugged, to indicate the answer was of no consequence.
The bark Godspeed was his ship, he said, and I was her operating master. It wasn't pressing business. I just wanted to talk some things over.
Were you and Mr. Wells on good terms?
Fair, said Carver. I'd call them fair. It's no secret that I was sweet on his wife, and quick to put my hand up when he passed. But I never came between them. I was decent to Wells, and Wells was decent to me. "Thank you, sir," said Broome to the justice. "Thank you, Mr. Carver."
"Your witness, Mr. Moody."
Moody stood up promptly. "Mr. Carver," he said, "when did you and Mrs. Carver first become acquainted?"
"We've known each other almost 20 years, said Carver.
"In other words, over the entire course of her marriage to the late Mr. Wells?"
"Yes."
"I wonder if you might describe the circumstances of your engagement to Mrs. Carver."
"I've known Lydia since I was a young man," said Carver, "and we'd always thought we'd marry. But then I got 10 years on Cockatoo, and during that time she fell in with Wells. By the time I got my leave ticket, they were married. I couldn't fault her. 10 years is a long time to wait. I couldn't fault him either. I know what caliber of woman she is. But I said to myself, if that marriage ever comes to an end, I'll be next in line."
"You married shortly after Mr. Wells' death, is that right?" Carver stared at him.
"There was nothing disrespectful about it," he said.
Moody inclined his head. "No, I'm sure," he said. "I'm sorry if I implied otherwise. Allow me to backtrack a little. When was it that you were released from prison?"
"June of 64, said Carver. "Nearly 2 years ago now."
"What did you do upon your release from Cockatoo Island?"
"I made for Dunedin," said Carver. "Found myself some work on a ship making the Trans-Tasman run. That was Godspeed."
"Were you captaining this craft?"
"Crew," said Carver. "But I made captain the following year."
"Mr. Wells was digging the field at Dunstan at this time, is that correct?" Carver hesitated.
"Yes," he said.
"And Mrs. Carver, then wife of Mr. Wells, was residing in Dunedin?"
"Yes."
"Did you see Mrs. Wells often over this period?"
"I had a drink at her place every now and again," said Carver. "She kept a tavern on Cumberland Street. And I was mostly at sea."
"In May of 1865, Crosby Wells returned to Dunedin," said Moody. "I understand that he made a purchase at that time." Carver knew very well that he was being led into a trap, but he was powerless to stop it.
"Yes," he said curtly. "He bought Godspeed."
"Quite a purchase," said Moody, nodding. "Not the least, because it was made so abruptly. The fact that he chose to invest in a ship, of all things, is also curious. Had Mr. Wells any prior interest in seafaring, I wonder?"
"Couldn't tell you," said Carver. "But he must have done, if he made the purchase."
Moody paused. Then he said, "I understand that the deed of sale is currently in your possession."
"It is."
"How did it come to be in your possession, please?"
"Mr. Wells entrusted it to me," said Carver.
"When did he entrust this deed to you?"
"At the time of sale," said Carver.
"Which was?"
"In May," said Carver. "Last year."
"Immediately before Mr. Wells quit Dunedin, in other words, and relocated to the Arahura Valley."
Carver could not deny it.
"Yes," he said.
"What was Mr. Wells' reason in entrusting this deed of sale to you?" said Moody.
"So that I could act as his proxy," said Carver.
"In case of injury, you mean?" said Moody. "Or death?"
"Yes," said Carver.
"Ah," said Moody. "Now, let me see if I have this straight, Mr. Carver. As of the beginning of last year, Mr. Wells was the rightful possessor of several thousand pounds worth of ore excavated from a claim in the Dunstan Valley. The ore was stashed in a safe at his residence in Dunedin, where his wife, an old and very fond acquaintance of yours, was living. In May, Mr. Wells returned home to Dunedin from the fields at Dunstan, and without notifying his wife, cleared the safe. He immediately sank the entire bonanza into the purchase of the bark Godspeed, entrusted that ship and its operation to you,
and promptly fled to Hokitika without informing any person of his destination or his design. Of course, Moody added, I am making an assumption in presuming that it was Mr. Wells and not another party who removed the ore from the safe. But how else could he have purchased Godspeed? He possessed no shares or bonds of any kind, we are quite sure of that, and a transfer of ownership, printed in the Otago Witness upon the 14th of May that year, explicitly states that the ship was bought for gold. Carver was scowling.
You're leaving out the whore, he said. She was the reason he quit Dunedin. She was the reason he fell out with Lydia.
Perhaps she was. But I will correct you in pointing out that Miss Wetherill was not, at that point in time, a member of the old profession, Moody said. The promissory note penned by Mr. Richard Mannering, which I submitted to the court this morning, explicitly states that Miss Wetherill is to be outfitted with an appropriate gown, a muff pistol, perfumes, petticoats, and all other items in which she is currently deficient. It is dated June of last year.
Carver said nothing.
You will forgive me, said Moody after a moment, if I remark that Mr. Wells does not seem to have benefited very greatly from the sequence of events that unfolded in Dunedin last May. You, however, seem to have benefited a very great deal.
Justice Kemp waited until Carver had seated himself beside his wife before calling the room sharply to order.
All right, Mr. Moody, he said, folding his hands. I see that you have a clear direction here, and I will allow you to continue with your present argument, though I will make the remark that we seem to have wandered rather far from the course as set down in this morning's bulletin. Now, you have submitted the names of two witnesses for the defence.
Moody bowed.
Yes, sir.
In the case of the defence witnesses, Mr. Moody will examine, and Mr. Brum will cross-examine, said the justice.
He consulted the ledger, then looked up over his spectacles and said,
Mr. Thomas Balfour.
Thomas Balfour was duly summoned from the cells. Mr. Balfour, Moody said when he had been sworn in, you are in the shipping business, are you not?
Have been for coming up 12 years, Mr. Moody.
You have Mr. Lauderback's private account, I understand.
I do indeed, said Balfour happily. I've had Mr. Lauderback's business since the winter of 1861.
Can you please describe the most recent transaction between Mr. Lauderback and Balfour Shipping?
I most certainly can, said Balfour.
When Mr. Lauderback first arrived in Hokitika in January, he came over the Alps, as you might remember. His trunk and assorted effects were sent by sea. He sent down a shipping crate from Nyttleton to Port Chalmers, and once the crate reached Port Chalmers, I arranged for one of my vessels, the Virtue, to pick it up and bring it over to the coast. Well, she got here all right, the Virtue, with the crate aboard. Arrived on the 12th of January, 2 days before Mr. Lauderback himself. Next day, the crate was unloaded, stacked onto the quay with all the rest of the cargo, and I signed for it to be transferred into my warehouse where Mr. Lauderback would pick it up after he arrived. But that never happened. The crate was swiped. Never made it into the warehouse.
Was the crate identified on the exterior as belonging to Mr. Lauderback?
Oh, yes, said Balfour. You'd have seen the crates stacked along the quay. They'd be indistinguishable, you know, were it not for the bills of lading. The bill tells you who owns the goods and who's the shipper and whatever you.
What happened when you discovered the crate was missing?
You can be sure I tore me hair out looking for it. I hadn't the faintest clue where it might have gone. Well, Godspeed was wrecked on the bar 2 weeks later, and when they cleared her cargo, what should turn up but the Lauderback crate? Seems it had been loaded onto Godspeed when she last weighed anchor from the Hokitika port.
In other words, very early on the morning of the 15th of January.
That's right.
What happened when the Lauderback trunk was finally recovered?
I did some sniffing around, said Balfour. asked some questions of the crew, and they told me how the mistake had come about. Well, here's what happened. Someone had seen the bill of lading, Mr. Lauderback, bearer, and remembered that their skipper, that's Carver, had been on the lookout for a crate so identified the previous year. They saw this crate on the wharf the night of the 14th, and they thought, here's a chance to earn a bit of favour with the master. So they open it up, just to be curious. Inside there's a trunk and a pair of carpet bags and not much else. Doesn't look terribly valuable, but they figure you never know. They go off to find Captain Carver, but he's nowhere to be found. Not in his rooms at the hotel, not at the bars, nowhere. They decide to leave it till the morning, and off they go to bed. Then Carver himself comes flying down the quay in a terrible bother, turns them all out of their hammocks, and says Godspeed weighs anchor at the first light of dawn, only a few hours hence. He won't say why. Anyway, the fellows make a decision. They pop the lid back on the crate, haul it aboard nice and quick, and when Godspeed weighs anchor just before first light, the crate's in the hold. Was Captain Carver notified of this addition to the cargo? Oh, yes, said Balfour, smiling. The fellows were pleased as punch. They thought there would be a reward in it, you see. So they wait until Godspeed is under sail before they call him down. Carver takes one look at the bill of sale and sees they've botched the job. Balfour Shipping, he says. It was Danforth Shipping. That was the one I lost. You've lifted the wrong bloody one, and now we've got stolen goods aboard.
Might we infer from this, Moody said, that Captain Carver had lost a shipping crate identified as belonging to Alistair Lauderback, with Danforth Shipping as its shipper, that contained something of great value to him?
Certainly looks that way, said Balfour.
Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Balfour.
My pleasure, Mr. Moody.
Broome, who very plainly had no idea where Moody's line of questioning was going, waived his right to cross-examine the witness for the defence, and the justice, making a note of this, called the second witness.
The Honourable Mr. Alistair Lauderback.
Alistair Lauderback crossed the breadth of the courtroom in five strides. Mr. Lauderback, said Moody, when he had given his oath, you are the former owner of the bark Godspeed, is that correct?
Yes, said Lauderback, that is correct.
According to the deed of sale, you sold the ship on the 12th of May, 1865.
I did.
Is the man to whom you sold the ship in the courtroom today?
He is, said Lauderback.
Can you identify him, please? Said Moody. Lauderback threw out his arm and levelled his index finger squarely in Carver's face.
That man, he said, addressing Moody. That's the man right there.
Can there be a mistake? Said Moody. I observe that the deed of sale submitted to the court by Mr. Carver himself was signed by a C. Francis Wells.
It's an out-and-out forgery, said Lauderback, still pointing at Carver. He told me his name was Crosby Wells, and he signed the deed as Crosby Wells, and I sold him the ship, believing all the while that I'd sold it to a man named Crosby Wells. It wasn't until 8-9 months later that I realised I'd been played for a fool.
Moody dared not make eye contact with Carver, who had stiffened very slightly at Lauderback's falsehood. Moody saw in the corner of his eye that Mrs. Carver had reached out a white hand to restrain him. Her fingers had closed around his wrist.
Can you describe what happened? He said.
He played the jilted husband, said Lauderback. He knew I'd been out and about with Lydia. Everyone in this room knows it, too. I made my confession in the Times. And he saw a chance to turn a profit on it. He told me his name was Crosby Wells, and I'd been out and about with his wife. I never even dreamt he might be telling a barefaced lie. I thought, I've done this man wrong, and I've made a bad woman of his wife.
The Carvers had not moved. Still without looking at them, Moody said, What did he want from you?
He wanted the ship, said Lauderback. He wanted the ship, and he got the ship. But I was blackmailed. I sold it under duress, not willingly.
Can you explain the nature of the blackmail?
I'd been keeping Lydia in high fashion over the course of our affair, Lauderback said, sending her old gowns over to Melbourne every month to get stitched up, and then they'd come back with the latest frills or flounces or what have you. There was a shipment that went back and forth across the Tasman in my name, and of course I used Godspeed as my carrier. Well, he'd intercepted it. Carver had. He'd opened up the trunk, lifted out the gowns, and packed a small fortune underneath them. The trunk was marked with my name, remember, and the arrangement with the dressmakers in Melbourne was mine. If that bonanza shipped offshore, I'd be sunk. On paper, I'd be foul of the law on theft, evasion of duty, everything. Once I saw the trap he'd laid, I knew there was nothing to be done. I had to give him the ship. So we shook hands as men, and I apologized again, and then, in keeping with his sham, he signed the contract Wells.
Did you ever hear from Mr. Carver, alias Wells, after that encounter?
Not a peep.
Did you ever see the trunk again?
Never.
Incidentally, said Moody, what was the name of the shipping company you used to transport Mrs. Carver's gowns to and from the dressmakers in Melbourne?
Danforth Shipping, said Lauderback.
Jem Danforth was the man I used.
Moody paused to allow the crowd in the gallery to comprehend the full implication of this, and then said, when did you realize Mr. Carver's true identity?
In December, said Lauderback. Mr. Wells, the real Mr. Wells, I should say, wrote to me just before he passed. Just a voter introducing himself to a political man, that's all it was. But from his letter, I knew at once that he didn't know the first thing about me and Lydia. And that's when I put it all together and realized that I'd been had.
Do you have Mr. Wells' correspondence with you?
Yes.
Lauderback reached into his breast pocket and withdrew a folded piece of paper. The court will note that the document in Mr. Lauderback's possession is postmarked the 17th of December, 1865. Said Moody.
Duly noted, Mr. Moody.
Moody turned back to Lauderback. Would you read out the letter, please?
Certainly.
Lauderback held up the paper, coughed, and then read,
West Canterbury, December 1865. Sir, I observe in the West Coast Times that you mean to make the passage to Hokitika overland, and therefore will pass through the Arahura Valley, lest you make some deliberately circuitous route. I am a voting man, and as such I would be honoured to welcome a politician at my home, humble though the dwelling is. I shall describe it so that you might approach or direct your course away as you see fit. The house is roofed in iron and set back 30 yards from the banks of the Arahura on that river's southern side. There is a clearing of some 30 yards on either side of the cottage, and the sawmill is some 20 yards further to the southeast. The dwelling is a small one with a window and a chimney made of clay-fired brick. It is clad in the usual way. Perhaps, even if you do not stop, I shall see you riding by. I shall not expect it nor hope for it, but I wish you a pleasant journey westward and a triumphant campaign, and I assure you that I remain, with the deepest admiration, Crosby Wells.
Moody thanked him. He turned to the justice. The court will note that the signature on Mr. Lauderback's private correspondence exactly resembles the signature upon the deed of gift penned by Mr. Crosby Wells upon the 11th of October 1865, in which a sum of £2,000 is to be given over to Miss Anna Wetherill by Mr. Emery Staines, with Crosby Wells as witness. It also exactly resembles the signature upon Mr. Wells' marriage certificate, submitted by Mrs. Lydia Carver, formerly Mrs. Wells, to the Magistrates' Court 2 months ago. The court will further note that these two signatures in no way resemble the signature upon the bill of sale for the bark Godspeed, submitted to the court by Mr. Francis Carver. Suffice to prove that the signature upon this bill of sale is indeed a forgery.
Brougham was gaping at Moody, open-mouthed.
"Just what do you mean by this, Mr. Moody?"
said the justice. "Simply that Mr. Carver obtained the Bark Godspeed by methods of extortion, impersonation, and fraud," Moody said, "and used the same tactics in thieving a fortune of many thousands of pounds from Mr. Wells in May of last year. A theft he achieved, presumably, with Mrs. Carver's help, given that she is now his wife." Brougham, who was still struggling to place the events of the past 5 minutes in sequence in his mind, petitioned for a recess. But his request could hardly be heard above the commotion in the gallery. Justice Kemp, raising his voice to a shout, requested the immediate presence of both Mr. Brougham and Mr. Moody in the magistrate's office. Then he gave the instruction for all witnesses to be placed in custody and adjourned the court. The House of Many Wishes, in which Lydia Wells is as good as her word, Anna Wetherill receives an unexpected visitor, and we learn the truth about Elizabeth Mackay. The face that No. 35 Cumberland Street presented to the thoroughfare was oddly blank. Pale clapboard siding, a mullioned shop window papered over with butcher's paper, a pair of curtained sash windows on the floor above. The establishments on either side, No. 37's was a bootmaker's and No. 33 a shipping agency, had been built very close, masking any sense from the street of interior proportion. Walking past it, one might even have presumed the building to be unoccupied, for there were no signs or legends above the doorway, nothing on the porch, and no card in the plate above the knocker. Mrs. Wells opened the front door with her own key. She led Anna down the silent passage to the rear of the house, where a narrow staircase led to the floor above. On the upstairs landing, which was as clean and blank as its counterpart below, she produced a second key from her reticule, unlocked a second door, and, smiling, gestured for Anna to step inside. A more worldly soul than Anna might have formed an immediate conclusion from the scene that greeted her. The heavy lace curtains, the redundant upholstery, the heady scent of liquor and perfume, the beaded portiere, currently tied back against the doorframe to show the dimly lit bedchamber beyond. But Anna was not worldly, and if she was surprised to encounter a scene of such sweet-smelling cushioned luxury at a boarding-house for girls, she did not express it aloud. On the walk from the quay to Cumberland Street, Mrs. Wells had exhibited a great range of refined tastes and particular opinions, and by the time they reached their destination, Anna felt more than happy to defer to them, her own opinions seeming all of a sudden very pale and feeble by contrast.
"You see that I take very good care of my girls," said her hostess.
Anna replied that the room was exceedingly handsome, and at this encouragement Mrs. Wells proposed a turn of it, directing Anna's attention as they walked to several ingenuities of decoration and placement, so that her compliments might be hitherto more specifically bestowed. Anna's chest had been delivered as promised, and was installed already at the foot of the bed, a signal that she took to mean the bed was intended to be hers. It had a handsome headboard, the wooden frame of which was all but obscured behind a great mound of white pillows, stacked in piles of three, and it was much broader and higher than the cot in which she habitually slept at home. She wondered whether she would be required to share a bed with someone else. It seemed much too big for one person. Opposite the bed stood a high-sided copper bath draped with towels, and beside it a heavy bell pull with a tasselled end. Mrs. Wells pulled this now, and from somewhere on the floor below there came a muted jingle. When the maid appeared, Mrs. Wells ordered hot water to be sent up from the kitchen and a plate of luncheon to follow it. The maid hardly glanced at Anna, who was very grateful to be ignored, and relieved when the maid left to heat the water on the kitchen stove. As soon as she was gone, Lydia Wells turned to Anna, smiled again, and begged to take her leave.
"I have appointments uptown which I must keep, but I shall be back in time for supper, and will expect us to take it together. You may ask Lucy for whatever you desire in the world. If she can find it, it will be found. Stay in the tub as long as you like, and use anything on the washstand that strikes your fancy. I insist that you make yourself entirely at home."
Anna Wetherall did just that. She washed her hair with a lavender-scented lotion and scrubbed every inch of her body with store-bought soap and stayed in the water for the better part of an hour. After she had dressed again, turning her stockings inside out to show their cleaner side, she spent a long time at the looking-glass fixing her hair. There were several bottles of perfume on the washstand. She sniffed all of them, returned to the first, and dabbed a little on her wrists and beneath her ears. The maid had left a cold luncheon on the table below the window, the plate covered with a piece of cloth. Anna lifted the cloth aside and saw a mound of ham shaved very nicely, a thick slice of peas pudding, evidently fried, a yellow scone spread with butter and jam, and two pickled eggs. She sat, seized the knife and fork laid out for her, and fell upon it. Relishing the flavours after so many tasteless meals at sea. Once the plate was clean, she sat wondering for some minutes whether she ought to ring the bell for the service to be cleared away. Would it be more imperious to ring or not to ring? Eventually she decided not to. She got up from the table and went to the window, where she drew the curtains, and feeling very contented, stood a while to watch the traffic in the street. The clock had struck three before she heard any sound from the floor below. Sudden voices in the passage, and then footsteps mounting the stairs, and then a brisk two-knuckled knock at the door. She had barely time to rise before the door was flung open, and in strode a tall, very dirty man, dressed in yellow moleskin trousers and a faded coat. When he saw Anna, he came up short.
"Oh," he said. "Beg your pardon."
"Good afternoon," Anna said.
"You one of Lydia's girls?"
"Yes."
"New girl?"
"I arrived today."
"You and I both," said the man.
He had sandy hair and a slightly grizzled look.
"Good afternoon to you."
"Can I help you?"
He grinned at this.
"We'll see," he said. "I'm looking for the mistress. Is she about?"
"She has appointments uptown."
"What time will she be back?"
"She said by supper time," Anna said.
"Well, have you any appointments before then?"
"No," Anna said.
"Good," the man said. "Mind if I reserve the next dance?"
Anna did not know.